Want to feel more confident with your finances this year? If you have 60 seconds, I can show you how quick and easy it is to start building healthy money habits that could last you the entire year just by using Rocket Money. Step 1, download Rocket Money. Step 2, link all your accounts and see your entire spending picture, your subscriptions, your upcoming bills, your due dates, everything. Step 3, tap a subscription you don't use and cancel it. Boom! That's money back every single month. Step 4, create a financial goal for something you want to save for, whether it be a vacation, a retirement account, or a pet's birthday. We don't judge. Now let the app automatically move small amounts of cash towards your goal. In a month, you'll see real dollars piling up. In a year, you'll be shocked at how much money you saved. Similar to the over 10 million members on the app that have saved up to $740 a year when using all of the app's premium features. Use the savings challenge as one step closer to feeling better about your finances today at rocketmoney.com/cancel. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. One more time, it's rocketmoney.com/cancel.
5 years ago, I was paying $65 a month for my subscriptions. Today, those same subscriptions cost $111, and I don't even use half of them anymore. That's why now I use Rocket Money to manage my subscriptions for me. The app gives you a list of all your subscriptions and reminds you of upcoming payments so you're not hit with any surprise charges. On top of that, it also sends you alerts when subscription prices go up, so you always know the price you're paying. If you decide you no longer want a subscription, you can cancel it right from the app. No customer service needed. And the best part is, Rocket Money even reaches out and tries to get you refunded for some of the money you lost. On average, people that cancel their subscriptions with Rocket Money save $378 a year. And overall, Rocket Money has saved its members $880 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Where the mist had been, there is a translucent, shimmering, wedge-shaped craft there. Okay? And it's like, wow. Now then, he says, senior officers turn up. Now, he's not specific where they turn up, but he says a number of senior officers turn up, and he will say, including the base commander, Colonel Gordon Williams, the guy in charge of RAF Bentwaters and RAF Woodbridge, in charge of 12,000 personnel, the top, top strike base in Europe, in Britain at that time, in the event of Soviet aggression, because we're talking still Cold War. Yeah? Cold War, the Soviet regime didn't collapse until 1991. So this is still heavily Cold War. And he says, another strange thing happens then. He says that from this shimmery craft, and he says, you can't look at it straight on because it's distorting. You kind of like looking at it through your peripheral. But he said that from off the fabric of the craft, a bubble seemed to emerge. Like, it's kind of weird, but it slips off. There's no doors open, there's no any kind of structure, but something slips off and it turns out it's like a bubble. And then he said the bubble then divides into three bubbles. And then he saw for the first time within the upper torso of some small being, entity, whatever you want to call them, and they are floating silently beside this craft. Colonel Holt and the senior officers with him approach. Williams goes forward and they stop in a face-to-face off situation, maybe 6 to 10 feet apart. He can't, from his perspective on the cordon, he can't see everything, but he can't hear any words being spoken. But he surmises that there's some kind of silent face-off, maybe telepathic communication going on. This is his story. Now, an unusual thing that adds a degree of realism to this, what is a science fiction scenario, is that he says at one point, somebody coming from the direction of where he'd come from the forest and the trees, there was a big, you know, like you stand on a branch and it breaks. Mm. And he said, when that happened, the three entities automatically close together and move back towards the fabric of the craft. It's a level of detail that you wouldn't normally add if you were thinking of a lie. Yeah, it's like an instinctive response that they had, but it's an instinctive kind of comment that suggests that he's not lying. All right? So they do that, and then they come back out. This face-off continues. He's then tapped on the shoulder and said, "You can leave now. Go back into the forest, back to the staging area." Okay? Last thing he sees is that this is all happening. But what's interesting is he says that there's maybe 10 or 15 people, security police. There is this ongoing confrontation or whatever, meeting going on between these entities and that. And he said what made it more interesting is he said there were two British police officers in uniform, never identified, never anybody's come forward. But he says they were in the background at the edge of the forest. But he said more remarkably that there were cine cameras. There were two cameras filming it. Early type big video, and I've checked, they did exist in 1980. Americans were a few years ahead of us in terms of technology. And also on a cine film on a tripod, the old official camera. And it was being filmed, which kind of is weird because it suggests that somebody knew that it was going to happen.
Mm.
Or it might happen. He then goes away, and then it kind of becomes a blur, but that's his story essentially. And so from 1983, when the story broke internationally, that's all you had until 1991. Then Colonel Holt retires in 1991, and it had featured, Larry Warren's story had featured in three or four important documentaries, including the famous CNN three-day special, cable news network special that they did, Bentwaters. And it was the Bentwaters incident. It was really good. You can still get it on YouTube. Holt retires, and almost as soon as Holt retires, he then goes on the offensive and says, "Nah, Larry Warren was a wannabe makeup. He wasn't there. Aliens, talk of aliens is rubbish. Absolutely, Williams wasn't there. Blah, blah, blah. He's a drug addict. He got kicked out." Which is basically exactly what Holt said. So he went on the offensive. Now, which is a bit weird. Instead of saying, "Well, I was involved. I wasn't there. Maybe other things happened." He wasn't in any way open to the fact that this could be another incident.
Mm-hmm.
He just went on the offensive. Jim Peniston retires in 1993. "Nah, Larry Warren's account. I don't know anything that anybody that will back up that story." Goes on the offensive. So John Burroughs, 1995, he comes out and says, "Nah, I don't remember any of that." Holt is the most vociferous, but basically the three of them are very anti Warren. Even though he's been in the public domain for 8 years on his own. All right? And was the first person to say, "I am, and I was there." Now, let's now move it forward to that transatlantic 4.5 hour call with Sergeant Adrian Bastinza. Yeah, so basically, Adrian Bastinza had made a few comments over the years on social media, but had never really done public and never really gone into too much depth. He was very private, and he didn't like what turns out all the infighting between witnesses. He really didn't like that at all, and he wasn't going to get involved. And it took me 2 years of trying to eventually get to speak to him. And there was an intermediary at one point who did a very good job in setting that up eventually. But when I spoke to him, he'd just come in from work. Now, this guy has gone on to have, he's retired now, but he'd gone on to have something like 34, 36 years as a police officer, law enforcement, and then he'd ended up retiring and kind of like began working with offenders in correction facilities in the US. So he'd stayed in the kind of police security environment. Absolutely genuine to the core. And I finally got to speak to him, and it turns out be this transatlantic 4.5 hour call through the night, exhausting, but arguably the most important interview I've ever done, because at that point, late on in the interview, 3 hours into it, when I started to get really, really tired, I had to say, "Look, I don't want to lead you at all, but I'm getting tired. I'm going to lead you to a point to bring up the subject of Larry Warren. What can you tell me? In cutting a long story short, what can you tell me about Larry Warren? And he said, well, I don't know why they picked him, but he went closer to the craft than I did. Whoa. Didn't know what he was going to say, but these are more or less what he said. And he basically confirmed that Larry Warren was there. He'd actually been put in the cordon and got closer to the craft than he did. He was alongside of him, basically, as part of the cordon. And he confirms that he called them silhouettes, some kind of life form, silhouettes. He didn't want to use the word alien. He didn't really want to use the word entity because he was very religious. And what he'd seen absolutely freaked him out. But he confirmed that he'd seen life forms, some kind of entities there. He said that there were British police there, which is what Warren had said. He said that there was at least one movie camera there taking motion picture footage. Nobody else had ever said that apart from Warren. And all these years later, 90% corroborates the story. And Warren is clearly tapped out and leaves, and it suggests that Bustinza stayed in that cordon. All right? But that's an amazing corroboration after all this time. And he said that Colonel Williams turned up and was there in the field. But he also says Holt was there, as does Warren all the years earlier.
Let me check, Gary. So I'm following this.
From what Holt will say.
Yeah, let me check. So I'm following this correctly. So for many years, is it fair to say that folks have disputed, or there's been a dispute around that Larry Warren testimony from folks like Holt, Peniston, Burroughs?
Only after they retired.
Yes, after they retired.
1991 afterwards. Yeah.
So, but that's been put on, and that kind of gains momentum, and that becomes the narrative that Larry Warren is the one who is being dishonest or making stuff up, and that's what you kind of hear floating around. However, we're not saying that in this case we're going to go with Larry Warren's account as accurate.
According to Sergeant Bustinza,
By Bustinza. And we're not saying that Holt, Peniston and Burroughs are lying, that it didn't happen, but we're saying, are you believing they are controlling the narrative? Once they come out of retirement, they are taking the lead on this to say, look, we're going to give away enough of the story that we believe or know happened, but what we're going to do is hide other aspects of this. Is that where we're at?
Basically, yeah, because if you think about it, in the way that the story emerged, at the time we now know, in 1980, early 1981, that the US Air Force really, really feared that the major newspapers would get hold of the story and it would become a huge, big media hype. They managed to keep it out of the papers and until it broke in 1983. Now, various researchers, including two housewives who became the first really proper civilian investigators of the case, Dot Street and Brenda Butler, who will go down in history as being the first civilian investigators. They were onto the MOD, onto the Air Force, trying to get information. No, nothing happened. And so between the incident happening in December 1980 and the memorandum coming out unexpectedly in around April, May of 1983, the US Air Force had steadfastly said, no, there's nothing, there's no paperwork, there's nothing, we're not going to say anything about it. And then suddenly the memorandum surfaces, and Larry Warren was really the person that got that out because he played a part in the story of it coming out, because various organizations had tried freedom of information in the US to get information out of the Air Force. And they just kept saying, no, we ain't got anything. No, nothing at all. And then suddenly, Larry Fawcett, who was a Connecticut police detective, he got involved. And they wrote back and said, we've got a witness now, a military witness. So this is for the first time. We've got a military witness who says he was involved. And that there must be some kind of paperwork about it. And indirectly then they went, oh, look, we found this memorandum. And that's how the memorandum came out. All previous attempts up until then had been met with a brick wall. So then it comes out. So the memorandum comes out, and what does that say? It infers that there's two incidents. First night, unknown triangular object, Peniston Burrows. 2 nights later, Holt and his team sees multiple UFOs and he signs it. Wow! So the Air Force had to admit that there were at least two incidents because it's in their own US Air Force headed document. Mm. But at that point there, I think they went, we've got to admit this now. Cat's out of the bag. But we're not going to admit anything else.
Mm.
Yeah? So I think that's basically the story. And when we get chance, we're going to poo-poo this alien story. And Larry Warren, by the way, was not the first one to mention aliens. Within days of the incident, Brenda Butler, one of these two housewife ladies who lived near the bases, or she did in particular, they often used to go on the bases and go to the music functions. And, you know, because for those people who've never lived in a military life, they're like small little towns, especially the US bases. And they had much better facilities than the Air Force, the Army. They had big bowling alleys. They had shopping arcades. It was like little America. And so the Brits would go in there and they'd listen to the music. They'd have top guests on, top stars. Nothing like when I was in the Air Force. But anyway, Brenda Butler got friendly with some security police officers, one of whom said to her within days of the incident happening, so late December 1980, something landed in the forest and aliens were seen. So that's where the first story comes from, not from Larry Warren. So this is indirectly another piece of corroboration that something to do with aliens did happen. Yeah. So, again, a bit of another misnomer there. So, suffice to say, that comes out. Larry Warren's story is largely, over the last, since 1991, been ridiculed. And he started to not be a feature in documentaries because, and have you made many TV documentaries, Andy, about your UFOs?
I've been in a couple as a talking head, not many.
All right, well, I've done lots over the years, and the way it works is like this. A researcher will ring you up and say, Gary, I understand you know about, a lot about Mendelssohn. Yes. Well, there's going to be a documentary. Colonel Holt's involved. Sergeant Peniston's involved. Do you want to get involved? That's how it kind of worked. Now, what would happen is that they'd ring up Holt and go, we're doing a documentary on UFOs about Mendelssohn. Would you like to get involved as our consultant? Oh, yes, says Colonel Holt. Who do you want to be in the show? Because they don't have a bloody clue.
Mm.
Researchers don't have a clue. They're young women, young men, first jobs. They don't have the students. They don't have a clue about the subject. So they're just like blind leading the blind. It's not like a political investigation where you've done a degree in politics to end up doing research documentaries. It's not like that at all. So they literally ring up and go to the likes of Holt, Peniston, Burrows and say, who do you want to be in the show? Well, who's not going to be in the show if you want to change the narrative? And that's literally what's happened over the last 30 years. And there's one other person that gets heavily involved, Nick Pope, man in the ministry. And there's a chapter in my book. There's nothing malicious in it. Everything I put is true. He claimed to be a UFO researcher. He was not. He was never a UFO researcher. He was not a trained investigator in terms of being a researcher. He just happened at 24 years of age to get landed at the MOD's UFO desk, which was a single person office reporting facility for the MOD. So literally somebody sees something, they either tell the nearest military base or they ring the police and say, I've seen this. Basically, either way, the police would fill out a little MOD form, a little pro forma form, and then in the old days, telex it, fax it to the MOD. It all went to this little MOD office, and they would supposedly investigate or respond in correspondence to the person making the report. That's what Nick Pope went into. 24 years of age, he did not run any department at all, ever. And certainly not when he was 24. He was there between the ages of 24 and 26. Nobody runs a department of that significance at that age. So he was basically an admin guy, dealing with the correspondence that would come in. Now, he would say that I investigated about 300 cases a year for the 3 years that I was there. Well, technically you did, because there'd be about 900 reports. Trouble is, 90% of those reports, and we now know this through the Freedom of Information Act and all the release of the MOD documents that happened for a few years ago, of which most people, researchers, why they've got copies, those little pro formas that were filled in very much depended on the person taking the report. So if the guy taking the report was mildly interested in what the witness said, they would fill it in properly. A lot of the times they didn't, and it was, oh, yeah, okay. One word, two words, saw light, blah, blah, blah. And they were hardly filled in. No real details taken. So 90% of those 900 cases, straight in the bin. They're just worthless in terms of an investigation. He did follow up on some cases, like the Rendlesham, not Rendlesham a little bit, but more from police officers or pilots. Then he'd make a few phone calls. Was there any radar tracks, blah, blah, blah. So he did a little bit of that. But this is 10%. So maybe 90 cases over 3 years instead of 900. Yeah, so, yeah. And of that, he never left the office. He just made a few phone calls. He basically wrote to people and said, yeah, the official line of the Ministry of Defence is nothing of defence significance that's ever occurred in UK airspace. That is basically still the position.
I didn't realize I was wasting $415 a month until I downloaded Rocket Money. I thought I had my finances under control until the app laid out all my spending and categorized it for me. Takeout, shopping, and unused subscriptions were quietly draining my account. And as a result, my savings took a backseat. But Rocket Money doesn't just tell you what you're wasting money on. It takes action to save you money. First, the app looks at your income and monthly expenses and calculates how much you can safely spend each day to stay under budget. Rocket Money also finds and cancels unwanted subscriptions for you and even negotiates better rates on your bills, so you have more money in your pocket. On average, Rocket Money members can save up to $740 a year when using all the app's premium features. Users love the app with over 186,000 five-star ratings. It's time to simplify your finances and take control of your money. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
I think there's a lot of stuff in the UFO topic in general. This can happen, and I see it with people, and I know people, and something gets written, and I think, and people will say, and I'd say it that way, it's not my opinion, I'm just going to say, people will say that Nick Pope had a front page headline where he was the UK's Fox Mulder, and he didn't correct the headline and ran with it.
He
and
did more.
That happens. Yeah, that happens a lot in the UFO community, where people have something said about them and they don't correct it and they run with it.
I'm not disagreeing with you on that, but what I'm saying is, because of his position, he was emerged into the UFO world, as it were, when he wrote his book, his first book, that was promoted heavily on the BBC, even before it was published. Can you imagine that? Me and you want to write a book, and the BBC, we want to get an actor in to recreate some of the things that's in your book, before it was even published. That never happened. So he had some help there, and I can't kind of know where that came from. But suffice to say that all I'm saying is that, yes, Nick Pope was only 24. He wasn't a trained investigator. He then claimed and publicly said it in many documentaries that he's been in, that I ran the UFO desk. He did not run. And subsequent FOI requests, of which are listed in my book, and other people's have done earlier requests, say that no, he didn't. He was just an office guy. And they actually say that of his working week, if we think of simple terms, 8 hours a day, Monday to Friday, a 40-hour week, only 20% of his time was UFO-related correspondence. That means one day of the week he looked at the UFO subject. And on the strength of that, he then made a career as the world's most, one of the world's most foremost experts on UFOs. Didn't correct it, but actually went further by saying, I ran. He actually said things that he shouldn't have said. He overplayed his position. In black and white on many, many documentaries, he said it. I've got clips, blah, blah, blah. And that was deliberately to give him the narrative.
Mm.
So if you want to get somebody high profile, we've got the XMOD guy. He ran the UFO desk. And there, though, he can control the narrative of any UFO case in Britain because he was based in the States, he became well-known on the US lecture tour, and he became world famous and did loads of documentaries. Now, it's not to have a go at him, but this is the reality, that he, in a sense, was allowed to assume a position where he actually had a great deal of press attention. So if something happened with a pilot case in the years after he left the UFO desk, and he was like the UFO, he was in every documentary, and they all said to him, Nick, in the press, there's this pilot case. What do you think? He had straight away access to the media. So there's this new thing on Rendlesham. What do you think, Nick? He could influence the media, drop of a hat. So I think that's not a coincidence. And what's not a coincidence is that on Nick Pope's own page, when I was researching the book, there's all the footnotes and references at the end. I found one, and it said video of interview of Nick Pope. And I just clicked on it thinking it'd be nothing. But it turns out that it's a guy just wanting to know a bit of background about Nick Pope's life. And he said something that is in the book that I think is really telling. He said that we knew that his dad worked for the MOD. He was a scientist and he worked for the MOD. And in a sense, he'd encouraged him to join the MOD. That's fine. But what emerged through this little video clip, which I reference in the book, is that his dad was not just a scientist. He was the top scientist in the Ministry of Defence, akin to being the Minister of Defence. He was that high. He sat alongside the Minister of Defence, who was a civilian. A civilian could not have the scientist was not a politician, so he could not hold the rank.
Mm.
So his duel was to answer to the Ministry of Defence, who was a politician, civil servant. Now, that makes you wonder how Nick Pope then got on the BBC, even before his book came out, pre-publicity, to make it a success, to launch him into the UFO community. I can't prove that, but it's, I think, a pretty good guess.
But like you say, that the book's 500 pages, it's very well researched. And again, folks, just a reminder, the title of the book is Non-Human, The Rendlesham Forest UFO Incidents, 42 Years of Denial. We're not going to go through every single thing, but what you've painted so far is a wonderful picture of how, and if you're on YouTube, there was a picture of it. It'll flash up on screen, but yeah, how a narrative can be created, controlled, distorted, and especially over time, how easily that can be moulded into as well. There's a few things I do want to touch on before we get to listener questions, Gary. The nuclear connection, you mentioned this earlier. It's a very badly held secret that there were nuclear weapons and assets at Rendlesham on those bases underground. However, what's really interesting to me that you've talked about is perhaps the number of nuclear weapons that were present on that base. Can you touch on that for me?
Yeah. Obviously, like I say, I had this kind of unique insight into workings of a protecting nuclear weapons because I did it for 3 of my 6 years in the Air Force place. That's why I always suspected there were more witnesses, because there'd been rumours of beams being shone down into the Bentwaters weapons storage area. We can come on to that with a witness who, first-hand witness, Steve Longero, said, I was there, I saw UFO, shine a beam down into the bunkers, and it did a grid-light search. Never had that before until the book, until I interviewed him. So again, you'd think that'd be 6 o'clock news, especially with Rendlesham. You'd think it's such, you know, it's such a powerful thing to now have come, you know, confirmed. We've got a first-hand witness. Nobody wants to go near it. Suffice to say, right, give me the point that you just gave me before and I'll go straight into it. What do you want me to explain?
So just from my understanding, when I hear nuclear weapons are present, okay, there's probably a couple of missiles. Right. I don't want to downplay a couple of nuclear missiles, but I've heard you say it's potentially, was it the most in Europe at the time?
Yeah, right. Basically, the nuclear weapons aspect is this. Whilst researching the book, I came across a document that said that Bentwaters held 25 nuclear weapons. So it was a confirmed, it was in writing, it was allowed to hold nuclear weapons. However, when I'd first met Colonel Holt in December of 2007 for a documentary for the History Channel, UFO Hunters, with Bill Burns, we'd ended up in a pub, arriving at the same time in the hotel, then going into the, there was like a restaurant part. We ended up chatting to each other because we weren't required for night filming. And I just met him and it was like we were just bouncing off each other. And in that conversation, he said, why, I don't know, but he said it. Maybe it was because I was ex-military, because I was serving. He said there were more nuclear weapons at Bentwaters than anywhere else in Britain. That's what he said initially to me. And I actually wrote this down in a little book later on because, and I still have that book, because I wanted to remember as much as he'd said. I wouldn't like to suss him out, but I just wanted to remember because things go over your head and you quickly forget stuff. So I wrote that down and I've still got it in this little book that I've got. Then 3 years later, while we're doing the walk around the forest, this came about because a documentary was proposed. The documentary was being commissioned by a private person with his money, brought us all together, including Nick Pope, including me, including Charles Holt. We all went to this big house and did some interviews there. We're all in hotels. And I'd said to Holt, is there any chance where if we're not required for filming that we can go around the forest and based on your tape recording and see if we conjures up any memories? He said, yeah, okay. And my second wife, Lynn, was with me at the time. And so we did that. We weren't required to film. We had a bit of spare time. So we did that. And we did a full walk round of the forest, which is about 4 hours or so, the whole thing. And intermittently, she was recording, with his permission, little clips, not specific clips, but just anything she wanted, on her iPhone. An early iPhone, so 2010. So she's not a great camerawoman or anything like that, so it's all over the place, but she would record the odd little clip, of which there's about 13 different scenes. As we're going around and stopping at various locations, and she didn't get it, unfortunately, on the audio, but she was with me when he said there were more nuclear weapons at RAF Bentwaters underground than anywhere else in Europe, which is what you just mentioned. So that was the second time. And she would happily go to court and take an oath on that and whatever. That's what happened. Now, so it wasn't the fact that it was allowed to be a nuclear base. It was the fact that there were far more nuclear weapons hidden underground at Bentwaters than there should have been. And people talk about why does Rendlesham happen in the first place? And I say it's all to do with nuclear weapons because a lot of people don't realise the political context of the time. In late December 1980, hundreds of thousands of Soviet troops, Soviet, not Russian, Soviet troops, were massing on the borders of Poland. Why? Because the Polish shipyard workers under Lech Wałęsa, who went on to become the president of Poland, or prime minister, president, I think, he was leading a kind of a revolution for free speech and blah, blah, blah. Now, historically, what had happened in the past when countries had started to rise up in Hungary and Czechoslovakia in earlier years, the tanks had gone in and quashed the rebellion just like that. So it began to look like the Soviet Union was going to do exactly the same to Poland in 1991. So the hundreds of thousands of Soviet troops massing on the Polish borders in late December 1980. I've always said that that has to be a connection with why UFOs turn up at Rendlesham, because they knew, for whatever reason, that there was a nuclear arsenal there And as we know, that there is a 70-80 year correlation between UFOs and all things nuclear. Going back to the 1940s. Yeah?
Yeah.
So anything nuclear. So they turn up, and what does Steve Longero say? He's in the weapon storage area. He sees a UFO over the forest that shines a beam down into the nuclear bunkers. The hot row of the bunkers was about 300 to 400 meters long. Bunkers all the way down. And he said it did this. Shining a beam down in an arc as if it was scanning and moving all the way down the 400 meter length. It was an inspection of some kind, in my opinion. Can't prove it, but that's what it infers, that it was some kind of inspection to say, what the hell have you got underneath there? We want to know. And I think that's kind of like wrenched from hand.
Yeah, and even it's a bit of a spurious connection, perhaps not, but even I remember Christopher Mellon in the Unidentified series was speaking to David Marler. David Marler's one of the world's foremost, you know, experts in triangular UFOs, folks. Check out his book. I've interviewed him several times. And Chris Mellon says to him, you know, the triangles, in his opinion, they're mapping, they're scanning the Earth for what he doesn't know. You then look at Rendlesham, you've got this wedge-shaped craft, this triangular craft, maybe not as big as what we hear reported in other sightings, but we still have lights, triangles, scanning and mapping, potentially underground nuclear assets. Really interesting. I don't think it necessarily is all disconnected. And on that, something I want to bring back as well, in preparing for this interview, I watched you speak with Ross Coulthart on News Nation, and he brought up to you, and this does go into the speculative, but you didn't shoot it down, no pun intended, that there may have been a psionic asset, and that's a phrase we hear a lot these days, that someone's using some kind of telepathy or their mind, CE5, whatever folks want to call it, to summon UFOs. That may have been something that was happening at Rendlesham at the time. You said there was no evidence directly for that. Is that something that you still hold lightly in terms of it could have been happening, but we don't know? Or is there any more on that?
I think what, well, I said something to Ross Coulthart off tape prior to my appearance on there, where I gave him some information about something that had come my way during my research for the book over the years. And what I will say is, in terms of what you're saying about a psionic psychic event, I don't see any evidence to prove that yet, because nobody in first person has said, I am John Smith and I was involved in psionics or doing some kind of... Nobody's come on the record and done that. People hinting at it, and it seems to be a buzzword. But, like I said, there were if we believe Bustinza and Warren, then there were cameras there. Well, why would you set up stuff in a field unless you thought something was going to happen? So it suggests that there's maybe some kind of communication, or that because UFOs had been seen on earlier nights, they thought, well, we'll chance it, we'll set up something. But it seems it's feasible to say... It seems an odd thing to do. It seems to infer a foremention of knowledge. It suggests that maybe something was known. Now, what I can say is, people have said, "Oh, it was military testing of equipment and radars." Like I said to Ross on the show, that can't be ruled out because it was a very secret area, and it was well associated with early developments of radar from the 40s and the 50s. It was early developments of nuclear weapons. So it was a very kind of secretive place. So that's not beyond the bounds of imagination that could have happened. The trouble is, as a former detective, you've got to say, is there anything to substantiate that? And there isn't. Now, what I said to Ross Coulthart, and I'm not going to it to the same depth, was during the course of my Rendlesham research, a guy who claimed to be a colonel in the US Air Force emailed me on several occasions to say that he was part of a kind of like an experimental radar team, for want of a colloquial term, and that they were using really strange high frequencies, and that something happened during one of these tests and something was brought in. Now, it all sounded absolutely kosher. It seemed totally genuine to me. And we exchanged maybe 7 or 8 emails. I'd thrown loads of questions at him. He'd come back. It seemed all very real. And here's the thing that stopped it in its tracks. I said, well, okay, you now need to prove to me who you say you are. You need to produce to me confidentially details about your military background, who you are, your photograph. I want to see the whole lot. Just for me, I will never reveal it. Yeah? Mm-hmm. And at that point, he walked away. So you have something that's unsubstantiated.
Yeah.
If he'd have given me his rank, his photograph, and I could prove his identity and got his permission, I would then have used him in the book and reproduced the emails. But as soon as I asked him for corroboration, validation, he walked away, never to be heard of again. So that's why I didn't include it in the book. Now, I am working on a second draft of the book now, and I've got various bits of other information, but I've decided that I'm going to publish those emails of which I sent to Ross Coulthard privately, and he was fascinated by them, but again, he had to accept that it's just a story without the corroboration, the name corroboration. But I would include them and tell the story like I've just told you now, because I think that there is now a case for saying, well, maybe this was something that was going on, or hints at something that was going on that I can discuss. But I'll just say, when I asked him for corroboration, validation, he walked away. But it was written in such a way that seemed totally convincing and seemed full of a lot of technical detail, way beyond my pay grade, that seemed totally bona fide. And I got the impression it was true, but when it came to it. So when I wrote the book as a cold case review, you don't really include that much speculation. And that's why it wasn't in. But now, 3 years on, I'm working on a second edition, and I've got much more other information that's accrued over this last 3 years. And I'm about to try to find a publisher. I think there is a case for now put it in its context and show, because I think people will be fascinated by what the email said. And maybe it might draw out other people who were involved in that scenario, if indeed it happened, to come forward and be named public and say, I am. And that's what I want. I still believe that with Rendlesham, there are many more witnesses, maybe 100 more witnesses who play little or big parts, but other incidents. I confirmed at the end of my book, 17 different time events over not 2 days, but we're now looking at about a week-long period from the 23rd, probably up to the 29th of December, maybe beyond. We're never going to settle that debate now because of the time that's elapsed. People's memories are not the same. People will remember certain things, vivid things, but not particular dates and that, unless you've got something to remember specifically that date, like Steve Wagner had, say, no, it's before Christmas, and he had a remembrance of to why, which I can't quite remember off the top of my head, but he did. So that's why I included it, because he had a reference point.
Want to feel more confident with your finances this year? If you have 60 seconds, I can show you how quick and easy it is to start building healthy money habits that could last you the entire year just by using Rocket Money. Step 1, download Rocket Money. Step 2, link all your accounts and see your entire spending picture, your subscriptions, your upcoming bills, your due dates, everything. Step 3, tap a subscription you don't use and cancel it. Boom! That's money back every single month. Step 4, create a financial goal for something you want to save for, whether it be a vacation, a retirement account, or a pet's birthday. We don't judge. Now let the app automatically move small amounts of cash towards your goal. In a month, you'll see real dollars piling up. In a year, you'll be shocked at how much money you saved. Similar to the over 10 million members on the app that have saved up to $740 a year when using all of the app's premium features. Use the savings challenge as one step closer to feeling better about your finances today at rocketmoney.com/cancel. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. One more time, it's rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Can we fly through some listener questions? Because you've been ages now, Gary, and I appreciate you've got a lot, and you've covered so much ground as well.
As long as you want, Andy.
Yeah, no, thank you. So listen, loads of people got in touch, and it's always a sign of a good show beforehand when so many people reach out to me. So thank you, folks, for that. If I don't get to your question, apologies, but I've got loads of them in here. So Stuart asks, what does Gary think of the information contained in the book, The Rendlesham Enigma by Gary Osborne and Jim Peniston, relating to information supposedly downloaded to Peniston when he touched a craft?
I deal with it in my book. Basically, I think there's a lot of red flags around it, and personally, I think it's false information. That's the simple answer. The reason why it threw up a lot of false flags is that he didn't mention it for 30 years until the 30th anniversary conference in 2010 at Woodbridge. There is a video of that still floating around to give the reference in the book. And people are going, why do you never told us this? And he said at the time, oh, well, who's going to believe me? It sounded crazy, blah, blah, blah. Trouble is, at the same conference, believe it or not, he actually then went off into a bit of a rant. He got a bit angry with the people asking questions of him and being a bit incredulous of him. He actually said that he'd done hypnosis in 1994, and it was contained in a book called Glimpses of Other Realities, a book written by Linda Moulton Howe that was published in 1998, and that contains a partial transcript. Now, part of that partial transcript begins with, can you see the binary codes under hypnosis? Well, if that's not a leading question, I don't know what is. So could you implant a memory, which is tried to say was happened to Larry Warren? When somebody says, can you see the binary codes? That's a leading question. It's not a real context around it. But suffice to say that he said that he didn't know what happened in his interview. What? If you'd never been hypnotized and then you came out with something really weird, or even when you just come around, you go, anything happened? I can't remember a thing. Anything interesting come out of it? Human knowledge, interest would do that. And they'd say, well, actually, I think you should listen to it. It was on video. So he'd listen back to it, human curiosity, and go, binary codes? What was binary codes? You see what I mean? So you can't then say, I didn't know anything about binary codes, when it actually found out about it, and it got to have found out about it in 1994. So how can he tell an audience in 2010 at the 30th anniversary he didn't know anything about binary codes? So that's a red flag. Then he went on a show called the Angela Joyner Radio Show. Sadly, she's not with us anymore. But this was done 10 or 11 days after that appearance at the Woodbridge Conference. So it's, I think, 11th, 12th of January 2011. And he's all over the place. And it's like, if you listen to that, which you can still listen to, and it's on YouTube, he's saying, I knew what it was all the time. Yeah, it's time travelers from the future. What? You just said you didn't know what it was. And the other thing that for me doesn't work as a former detective is he said that he was compelled the next day, having touched the craft, feeling the download. I do believe he touched the craft, but he was asked that question in various documentaries over the years and interviews in magazines, and he'd said, I just touched the craft and that was it. Why didn't he mention it then? All these years later, he didn't mention it. And then suddenly in the documentary, I've had this download of zeros and zeros and ones, felt so compelled the next day to write it out, almost like I'm exercising a ghost, I've got to write it down. I didn't know what they were, and they stayed in his pocketbook all those years until John Burroughs, whilst making the documentary about Rendlesham, he gets his pocketbook out and John Burroughs says, what's those? When he's flicking through the pages, John Burroughs, and he goes, well, I wrote them down, but I didn't know what they were. John Brooke goes, well, that's binary code. What's binary code? It's a ludicrous kind of situation. I'm not saying John's lying, because I think that's the story he gives, and who's to say that that's not true? But what I'm saying is, the Jim Peniston side, to me, doesn't add up. He's a genuine witness to, he did go into the forest, there's no doubt about that. What he saw, the small triangle crap, don't disagree with that at all. But this story of having this download of information, of which they then say were time travellers from the future, 8,100 years in advance, planetary exploration, gives loads of coordinates around the world, including the High Brazil, which is a mythical island off Ireland, including the Giza pyramids, blah, blah, blah. They then subsequently wrote another book, all to do with these codes and whatever.
Mm.
One of the things that happened is that he said that there were originally 6 pages of binary code. And then I'd heard him on other shows saying there were 8 pages, there were 10 pages, there were 12 pages. I think I'd know. if this was the defining moment of your life, and somebody said to you, well, how many pages of binary code did you write down? Even if you genuinely didn't know the answer to that question the first time it was asked, which is feasible, you'd go, well, hang on a minute. There's 16 pages. But he'd already said there were 6, there were 8, there were 10. Once you'd actually physically gone through your pocketbook and counted them for yourselves, I guarantee you the way your mind would work, given the level of importance of this incident, you would not forget how many pages you knew. And he was inconsistent with the pages. So the first time somebody says, how many pages? I don't know. Oh, there were 8. 8 pages. He'd never forget 8. Because other people would ask him, oh, yeah, I've done that. 8.
Yeah.
No, it kept changing. And it turns out there were 16 pages. Huge red flags. So for me, and I had it's in the book, I had a Facebook online conversation with Gary Osborne, his co-author, and he had to admit that it's a standalone account. There is no corroboration to the binary download at all. No corroboration. So it's a bit like me saying, I had a dream in the night, and actually I'm Jesus reborn. So you're all now my subjects.
Yeah.
Is anybody going to believe me?
No. Some people probably would these days.
Well, some would. But what I'm saying is the vast majority wouldn't, because it's a standalone account. There is no corroboration. And that's, I'm not saying you can't have downloads of information. I think you can under various guises, not just UFO related. But what I'm saying is, in this incident, the story is inconsistent. He has made a lot of contradictory statements early on when it all came out, and for me it's a lot of red flags, so I would err on the side of caution, say there's no corroboration, and I personally think it's made up.
No, again, that's something quite often in the UFO community. I think a big thing recently has been the Chris Bledsoe story, where more and more folks are scrutinizing the initial story, the initial incident, the experience, and then what's been added on and tacked on to that as time's gone on, the heavy religious angle. Folks, and I'm not saying this, folks are referring to it as more and more like a cult, the way things are going, the information being presented one way when there's a lot of Starlink satellites and, you know, being posted and aircraft. And yeah, that happens quite often in the UFO stories, where there's a bastardization of an incident. Yeah. And it's not to say the original story didn't happen, but for multiple reasons, things change.
Yeah, correct. That's a good summary.
Chris asks, and he does some selfless promotion here, and I'm going to let him away with it. He has a book out called The Citadel Directive, folks. I would encourage folks to go and check that out, by Chris Stokes. I've not touched on it yet, but I'm going to get to it at some point. But it touches on a fictional UK crash scenario, and he really wants to know your take, Gary, on if a genuinely unknown craft came down in the UK today, do you think there are established protocols for how the police, the military, and the government would handle it, or would they have to improvise?
I think the probably answer is yes, there are probably very secret protocols at the highest level of the police and the Ministry of Defence. But I guess it would depend on how and where it happened. If it's in an ultra-remote place, the local police might get there, and they're not going to be aware of any of these protocols. They may do things legitimately and treat it like, well, if someone's crashed, we'll just call the army in. So then, sooner down, within a few hours, a story would emerge. The question that you've got is, what happens if it happens in daytime or near a populated area where loads of witnesses? We're into the other side of ufology, which is kind of the disclosure angle. And I'm obviously privy and know a lot of the people involved in that world with, you know, I have lots of discussions at high level on that. But what I'm saying is, there are things that could happen, but it depends on the circumstances. So if something, you know, like people say, well, what could cause disclosure now? Carl Nell said we're now maybe looking at a catastrophic disclosure. Something happens involving UAP that's so there, can't be contained by the media, by the authorities, it's happened. I've always said that if the Phoenix Lights happened, that happened in 1997, happened again, This time, we've got 4K, 8K cameras. We've got live streaming. Media, everybody would start live streaming. This was seen for several hours, maybe 50, 60,000 people on its route before it stopped over Phoenix. So people, it was seen low over little hillsides and mountains. If that was to happen again, there's a good chance the authorities could not contain the media that would be created because everybody would jump on the live streaming and they simply could not control it. In 1997, they could. Now, if we take the point to what you're saying in the UK, if there was a crash, well, it would depend on how it was and where it was as to whether you contain that. You see what I mean? Because if it was in a town. Now, for example, in 1954, a lot of people don't realise this, but there was a football match, a professional match playing in the Italian league where a UFO was seen over and stop over the pitch.
Yeah,
you know, 200 or 300 feet up, it stopped the game. Everybody's looking, the crowd are looking. Several international players were on the field. They've corroborated that this incident occurred, and then it often flew away. A typical kind of flying disc. Now, if that incident happened on Sky Sports, I wonder what would happen, because there wouldn't be a protocol then. They'd probably film it and go, "What's that?" And then somebody would say, "Cut the feed," and whatever. Stop the footage, but lots of people will be going live streaming. Well, what the hell is this? The FA Cup final? What is that? You see what I mean? So it's a question of how and the circumstances of how. But it's entirely feasible that the police, at very highest chief constable level, are privy to a set of protocols and the senior ranks of the Ministry of Defence, etc.
And is that fair to say, and just to play devil's advocate, and I always like to be impartial where I can, that you wouldn't even necessarily have at that highest level the conversation be around a non-human craft, especially in 2026, it could just be an unknown craft,
and you
would assume Chinese, Russian, yeah, it could be toxic, spy craft.
Unknown origins, come down in the fields near Leeds, get there, cordon it off, take it away, whatever, never to be seen again. Which is classic retrieval. And we know now through, if we accept legacy programs and reverse engineering programs, which there's more and more people coming forward to say that that is a reality, that these squads, for want of a better word, these teams are probably in each country. And certainly I would think the SAS may be getting involved at some point, our highest level best forces getting involved. Under American led, I would think, because we're all part of the Five Eyes, we're very close. Even though the UK is very, very backward now on the UAP phenomena and are totally at odds with everything we've ever done with the Americans, because the Americans have gone much more open, legislation being passed, more legislation trying to be passed in the States. Well, in the UK, it's like going back to the 50s. We're all laughing at it and whatever. Well, behind the scenes, that we know that that's not the case because Freedom of Information requests have established it in, May of 2023, that a UK representative spent a full day getting UFO, UAP briefed at the Pentagon along with other Five Eyes nations. So we know that there's a public face, as there has always been, and there's a real behind-the-scenes face which treats it very seriously.
Leeds wouldn't be bad for a crash retrivable. I can get there in about an hour and a half.
Yeah, I can get there in half an hour.
Yeah, cracking big services down that way as well that I quite like. So, yeah. John asks, and this is a book that's coming out in June, so I don't know if you've seen this yet. What is your opinion on the release and potential impact of Jonathan Kaplan's KC's book, Not for Disclosure, UFOs, the World's Best Kept Secret, due for release in June? Is its release a tentative tone the water by the British establishment, and will it refresh attention towards the writings of Lord Hill Norton, Sir Peter Horsley, etc.?
I don't really know anything about it. Suffice to say that anything that claims to be doing that, I'll look at it and give an opinion then. But at the moment, I have no opinion on it.
Yeah, I don't yet either. I've had a few folks send me links to it to say this book's coming out. I don't know how to touch the guy yet and stuff.
Jay Stratton, who ran the US Task Force on UAP, he's got a book coming out. And he's recently, for the documentary, The Age of Disclosure, said in the trailer, I have seen non-human bodies and non-human craft. Mm. Well, that's a pretty, if somebody's going to know, he's going to be the guy that knows. So again, I wait with anticipation for his book.
Absolutely. Still no information on that yet either, folks. But obviously we do know Lou Elizondo has a second book coming out, Reckoning, before that, which is surprising that he's got another book coming out before Stratton's even gets released. Little Melly says, is there any evidence or stories of BAE Systems' involvement in the UAP phenomenon?
BAE Systems?
Yep.
Not that I'm aware of. I'd have to reread these emails that I've just alluded to from this guy who was a radar specialist, American radar specialist, but I wouldn't think that they'd be using BAE equipment if they were Americans.
Mark asks, as a Londoner myself, the UAP topic is far too quiet here in the UK amongst politicians. Is it possible that the US do not share black project programs with the UK? And if so, what do you think the reasons could be?
I think it's entirely feasible that Starmer doesn't have a clue, because he'll come and go. It's the old thing about, do all presidents know? Do they ever need to know? And the old civil servants are there for 30, 40 years. Presidents come and go. I doubt that Starmer is fully briefed. I suspect that his defence ministers would have more briefings on it. But whether there's a full need for him to know, I doubt it. I think there's a lot going on behind the scenes. I've spoken to Luis Elizondo in the past, and he's alluded to things going on in the UK behind the scenes. And he's kind of a guy that would probably know. We know recently that the Bank of England, there's a recent article by a lady called Helen McCaw, who used to work for the Bank of England. She's done another article. She first came about talking about UFOs in the Bank of England, and we need to prepare for how the currency might be affected by an announcement that we're not alone. She's just written a letter to the current Bank of England, and that was recently publicised in an article. So that's, things are going on in the background. It's a question of what's going on. I also know that things are going on in certain European countries behind the scenes about airspace and maybe adopting a set of guidelines to deal with UAP, which is at the moment non-existent. In February 2024, I launched a website, an initiative called UK Pilots Reporting UAP. I put press releases out. I wrote to aviation publications and organizations asking them about, can we try to get a coordinated reporting system? No response, no response from the mainstream media. They won't go near the story. So that says to me that this is UFOs in this country at the moment. There is a definite downer at the moment to good UFO stories.
Couple more points here. One from Rob. He says, I've been fascinated by the Todd Morden incident for years now. Has there been any further insights into this case in recent times?
When I first retired from the police in 2013, I did a lot of research on it, and also around 2002, 2003, I launched the database of police officers in January 2002. I soon met Alan Godfrey. I then researched his story for about 18 months. I ended up writing a fictional film screenplay, such was, I thought, this is really cinematic. One of my private passions in life is the cinema, and I dabble at writing, and I've written 5 amateur full-length screenplays, one of which is about Alan Godfrey's story, because I thought that it was such a good story that would come across well in a documentary, in a film scenario, or a play for today, that kind of thing. Alan's story is a really good, genuine case, never been adequately explained, and it's a mysterious thing. The Todd Morden aspect comes from the fact that Alan Godfrey had his own sighting in November of 79, and it had you know, it was a great, great case. But he was also the same officer who went to the scene of a mysterious death on a coal heap in Todmorden at a railway yard. And the story goes that when he got there, the body was atop of a coal skip on its back. There was no shirt on the person. It was like as if it had been taken off. There was still money in his pocket, so robbery wasn't a motive. But he was laid on his back dead. There was a strange substance on his neck that was never identified. And that has been actually corroborated by the coroner of the inquest into the death, who said on camera for a TV documentary that the substance was sent away for analysis and was never identified. So that's a pretty good thing from James Turnbull, who was the coroner of that inquest. And he basically said that if somebody told me that it was UFO related, I wouldn't be that surprised. That's the way he kind of phrased it. Nothing new's come that's emerged down the line. No new witnesses have come forward, that kind of thing. But it, to me, it's a very valid case, and it's got some mysterious aspects to it. But Alan Godfrey's own encounter was an excellent case, so that's still unexplained.
Gary, I've got one more listener question, and then what I'm going to suggest is I've got loads of stuff still to ask you, but I'm going to run out of time because I've got to do some football coach trips with my little boy. What I was going to say was, I'll ask you this coming up question, but if you could come back on in the near future, it'd be great to go through anytime. Perhaps some of the cases in the database, talk about your work at the press club, the Brazilian Senate, all that kind of stuff, because there's so much there. I don't want to just skip through it just now. So we'll arrange that separately. But right now, let's finish off with this question, because you've been brilliant with your time, Gary. From Rick, he asks, with the way the majority of the world handled COVID-19, can we say for sure the majority of the world can handle disclosure? And if so, why?
I totally think that we can handle disclosure. The world's moved on a lot from, say, the 60s. There was a very famous study done that was published in the Brookings Institute report about 1960 when it was released. And basically it asked the question, what would be the effect on society if there was disclosure? And it basically said, well, there might be economic chaos, religious chaos, and the people will be screaming in the streets kind of thing. And so therefore they decided not to think that it was a good idea. I think we've moved on from there. We now live in a world of incredible technology by our human standards, with smartphone technology and whatever. Most people play science fiction-based games. They talk, we have a huge genre of science fiction films, and it's part of our DNA now. So I actually think that if disclosure happened tomorrow, 20% of the world's population may be very frightened, because those people would probably be frightened by anything, a bit like COVID. You know, people, it's the end of the world, that kind of thing. There will be some people that will be adversely affected and suffer with mental health trauma. But I suspect that the 80% of the world would just think, wow. It depends on when it happened. If they said there's an invasion, then there might be panic. But if they just said that we confirm that there's life and that we think that these things are real, it's non-human intelligence, we're not sure where they're from, but we're now convinced that we're dealing with some other intelligence. I think under those circumstances, people would still go to work the next day because they've got to earn a living. The world's not going to stop. So I think the world's moved on now. I think we're in a place where we could handle it depending on the scenario. If somebody said there's going to be an alien invasion in 2028 and we've got good information, then that might be different and you wouldn't disclose it, or you'd deal with it in a different way. But if we're just talking about, are we confirming that there's life out there, we're dealing with something, whether it be interdimensional, non-human intelligence, extraterrestrial, which I still think the majority is based on the contact phenomenon and the four species that Eric Davis has recently confirmed, the Nordics, the Greys, the Insectoid, the Reptilian. He mentioned that in a Congressional UFO Disclosure Fund meeting, in Congress. So it's incredible. So I think we can deal with it, and the world will generally go on, but there will be a certain percentage of people who will initially be very traumatized by it and may remain traumatized by it.
Well, Gary, the book Non-Human, The Rendlesham Forest UFO Incidents, 42 Years of Denial, is available on Amazon. Is that the best place for folks to get it?
It's the only place you can get it because there's a story in itself in that is that I chose to self-publish because I wanted to get the information out there. And if I'd have flagged up and said, my book is coming out with so-and-so, so-and-so, and it's going to be released on such and such a date, I have no doubt that some people would have tried to stop my book coming out. They wouldn't have had a leg to stand on, but the legal situation could have slowed it down, temporarily halted it, blah, blah, blah. Such is the way that the case has been controlled in the narrative. That's what I maintain. I think there's a lot more witnesses out there who deserve to have their stories told. So if you really want to know about these 17 different town incidents and the other events that have, of witnesses that I've interviewed, then I'll send a link and you can get it on there. But I self-published because I knew that there was no pre-publicity whatsoever. Whatsoever. Who releases a book with no pre-publicity? Would you do that over your book? You didn't know. You were doing pressing it, say, it's coming out. I didn't because of the subject matter, and I knew that once I pressed that button, once 50 people got hold of that information, if nobody else ever bought the book, the information that was in there that was explosive has never been told on TV, never been told in documentaries. It was out there. And so that's why I self-published.
Well, listen, Gary, let's catch up again soon and we'll go over that database. We'll talk about your work with the press club, your time in Brazil, the work with ICER. There's a whole lot of stuff to cover there and no doubt some more Rendlesham as well.
Yeah, no problem at all. Thank you very much.
That's all for this episode of That UFO Podcast. Thank you so much for listening and watching. If you enjoyed the show, please follow, subscribe and leave a rating or review wherever you get your podcast. It really helps others find the show. If you're watching on YouTube, hit like, subscribe and turn on notifications so you don't miss future episodes. You can also support the show directly and get early access, ad-free episodes and bonus content on Patreon or by subscribing on Apple Podcasts, Spotify or YouTube memberships. All the links are over at thatufopodcast.com or in the show description below, along with merchandise and more. Don't forget you can also pick up a copy of my book, Atlas of Unidentified Flying Objects, available now in all good bookstores and through online retailers, including Amazon. Big thank you again to all of you for listening and tuning in. Until next time, keep looking up. You never know what you might see.
It wasn't a tic-tac and not quite a saucer, more like a hubcap designed by Chaucer. A little baroque and quite steampunk, like Alice was playing bass for the Parliament of Funk. The little fucker hovered right outside of my window, and when I shoved out the screen, he made it an issue. I don't think he expected me to see his ass, but I'd had some champagne and smoked a little grass.
The holidays are expensive. You're paying for gifts, travel, decorations, food. And before you know it, you've blown way past what you were planning to spend. Don't start the new year off with bad money vibes. Download Rocket Money to stay on top of your finances. The app pulls your income, expenses, and upcoming charges into one place so you can get the clearest picture of your money. It shows how much to set aside for bills and how much is safe to spend for the month so you can spend with confidence. No guesswork needed. Get alerts before bills hit. Track budgets and see every subscription you're paying for. Rocket Money also finds extra ways to save you money by canceling subscriptions you're not using and negotiating lower bills for you. On average, Rocket Money users can save up to $740 a year when using all of the app's premium features. Start the year off right by taking control of your finances. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.